Mark Collier for Thomas Matters Radio. Sponsor today, Omega Processing Solutions. Always a sponsor on For Thomas Matters Radio. Are you an independent business owner looking for a better way to process credit cards? You should probably call Omega Processing Solutions right here in Fort Thomas, Kentucky. They have a straightforward application and approval process. Makes everything really simple. It's 2 pages long. I've seen it. Even I can do it. Omega will act upon your application quickly, usually within the same day. They never outsource any of the functions, which means that Omega Processing Solutions can get you from applications to up and running in a very timely manner. To schedule an appointment with them, you can call them at 866-888-9724, 866-888-9724. Send an email to info@omegap.com. They're going to get you started on the road to offering your customers additional payment options really quick, which means more sales for you, which is why we're in this business together, folks. So today on the show, we are going to talk to Anjanette Levy of Local 12. Anjanette is a reporter. She's a Cincinnati gal. She was in Green Bay, Wisconsin during the period when Stephen Avery, who, if you've been you have to have been living under a rock if you've not heard of Making a Murderer, the original series on Netflix, which has premiered about 3 weeks ago at this point. And Anjanette covered the trial for her local affiliate, WFRV-TV, that was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. She was there from 2004 to 2010. She's now, like I said, at WKRC-TV in Cincinnati. That's Local 12. She's a graduate from Turpin High School. She went to UC, so she's about as Cincinnati as it gets. So we're going to talk to her, and I'm not going to put her on the spot. I mean, she was a reporter. She was an independent source on this subject, which I think is really kind of a perspective that not many people are getting. And you're probably seeing a lot of these faces. If you've watched the series on Netflix, you're seeing the faces now appear on the Today shows of the world, or, you know, Fox, NBC, that type of thing. But you're hearing from the prosecutors, or you're hearing from the family, or you're hearing from the defense, but they're going to give their own spin to the whole thing. So I think Anjanette will be able to give an unbiased view of what happened. I'm not going to put her on the spot and ask her what happened, because I just think she's too good of a reporter to give her own opinion. So we're going to talk to her about the process, what it was like to cover this trial. Did she think that this trial was going to blow up in the way that it has? And now if you haven't seen it, you know, I'm going to give you a chance to get out now and not listen to the podcast, but we are going to talk about what happened. So spoiler alert, if you have not seen Making a Murderer, turn this off now. Go ahead and watch it. The first episode is free. You can, even if you don't have Netflix, you can watch it on YouTube. Just type into the search box on YouTube, Making a Murderer, first episode is the first time that Netflix did that. But it's a... just to give you a little bit of background, and I'm not going to go over the entire thing because it would just take way, way, way too long, but it was a documentary that was filmed over 10 years on the trial of a local guy in Wisconsin. It's a rural Wisconsin area in Manitowoc County in Wisconsin. And in 2003, after 18 years in prison, there was some DNA evidence proved that this guy, Stephen Avery, did not commit basically a brutal sexual assault that he had been accused of. So he was in jail for 18 years. He was freed. And it appeared that a long injustice had finally come to an end. It looked like it was going to be a happy ending. But as soon as he got out, and there was a lawsuit that he was filing against the county for, you know, wrongful arrest, wrongful imprisonment, whatever. And he was due to have a very big payday. I think the original lawsuit was like $36 million. It was going to cripple the county. So after, you know, they filed this lawsuit, and it looks like they're going to win. You know, it looks bad for the sheriff's office, the individual officers that were named in the suit. But soon after that lawsuit was filed, Avery was accused of the murder of another person, Teresa Halbach, who was a photographer who was last seen on the Avery family property to photograph a minivan. Stephen Avery and his family had owned, I guess it was like a junkyard. They just had hundreds and hundreds of old junked, you know, cars, vans, whatever. And Teresa Halbach was a photographer who worked for Auto Trader magazine. So she was murdered. And making a murderer illustrates the procedures in the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office that led to both Avery's original conviction and a second conviction after his release of the murder. It also involves his nephew. His name is Brendan Dassey, who was accused in the murder investigation, and the show also depicts his trial as well. So it is probably, I started watching it, this is embarrassing to say, but I started watching it Saturday night on, it was last weekend, about 9 o'clock, and it was one of those things where I just 100% binged on it. I think I got through like 6 or 7 episodes Saturday into early Sunday morning, got up, did the family thing, church, breakfast, whatever. Bengals came on, put little man down for a nap, and during the Bengals game, I wrapped that puppy up. It was that enthralling, and Netflix is not paying me for this, although they Netflix, if you want to sponsor the podcast, certainly please give me a call. It was one of the best things I've watched in a long, long time. For me, it was because, you know, and 99% of the people that watch it have no inner dealings or inner knowledge of how the criminal justice system works. And to me, the really interesting part was not whether or not the police in Wisconsin were framing this guy who they didn't like, which was one of the storylines of the show, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on with Ann Jeanette Levy of Local 12. It was not the fact that some of the evidence seemed really shady. It was the fact that if you don't have an inner working knowledge of the criminal justice system, without a couple of things, the system does seem stacked against you. And here are the things that you basically need. It seems like you need competent, which means expensive, attorneys. And that is kind of exemplified in the fact that Stephen Avery was able to get two really, really good attorneys. And he was able to do so because when he was first imprisoned wrongly for 18 years, that $36 million figure, which was what he was suing for, he ended up getting around $400,000, mainly in part because the second murder charge came around. And at that point, you know, they thought, well, we're not going to give him more than $400,000. Seems like a lot of money. And it is, but it's nothing compared to probably what he could have gotten had this discharge not come around, which may be motive for some of the framing that was perceived in the documentary. So he gets $400,000, and the only thing that he can spend it on at this point, he's sitting in jail, there's no bond available, is spend it on two good attorneys. He gets two really good attorneys. Now, his nephew, Brendan Dassey, did not have a good attorney. And in fact, he was appointed an attorney who he did a couple of things wrong. First of all, Brendan Dassey was 16 at the time of when this whole thing came about. So his attorney lets him talk to the investigators without him being present, without his mother being present. It was presented later on that Brendan Dassey had a reading level at grade 4. And they end up getting him to confess. Some of the things that they confessed to, that he confessed to, was that his uncle had called him, Stephen Avery had called him, over to his trailer. They lived on the same property at the junkyard. His uncle called him, told him to come over, and when he came over and walked into his uncle's trailer, he had seen him, Teresa Halbach, shackled to the bed with manacles and chains. And basically the investigators, and this is, you know, they do show some interrogation video. It's a 10-hour documentary, so they show quite a bit of it. They show the investigators basically leading Brendan down this path. And, you know, whether or not he did it or not, I don't know for sure. But it sure seems like the way that his confession came about was that these investigators were using tactics that basically pushed him in a certain direction. Now, I don't know. I mean, that's for other people to judge whether or not he did it or did not do it. But it certainly seemed like that in the documentary. But my whole point for talking about that is his attorney was terrible compared to Stephen Avery's, who were very, very good. So I think that points to a larger systemic problem with the system in general, which is you better have a good attorney, and if you don't, odds are really, really stacked against you. So that's number one. Number two is that in the criminal justice, you're perceived to be innocent. And the way that this was played out into the media, some of the tactics that the prosecutors used, there was no way for Stephen Avery or Brandon Dassey to have a jury pool of their peers not have a tarnished opinion or an opinion going in whatsoever, whether or not they were guilty or not, because everything played out in the media beforehand. So, you know, as a media member, I want to ask Anjanette, do you think that they used some of the local media? And I don't know some of the things that she reported versus some of the things that everybody else reported. I know her to be a very good reporter, but there's no doubt that the prosecutors were trying to use the media to tarnish that jury pool. So we're going to talk to her about that as well. And listen, there's no way that I can give all the details or do the justice that this series Making a Murderer goes through in 10 hours in a course of a 30-minute podcast. So we're going to talk to Anjanette, and we are going to, you know, go through some of the questions that I think people are Googling at this point. I mean, if you Google Making a Murderer right now, I think you'll get like something around 400,000 inquiries. There's a petition that's going around right now that is up to about 400,000 names that people have signed for President Obama to seek some type of new trial for Stephen Avery and Brandon Dassey. So hopefully we'll ask Ms. Levy some of those questions, see if she can give us some insights, and we fully expect this podcast to be a really, really popular one. So with that, we have Anjanette Levy on the Fort Thomas Matters Radio podcast call-in line. Anjanette, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being on the show. So you were a writer and associate producer at Local 12 in 2002, 2004, went to Green Bay, WFRV, for 6 years. Now you're back home. You're a Cincinnati gal.
Yes, I am.
Turpin, UC. And if you Google Anjanette Levy, a couple of things will come up. Obviously, right now, the Making a Murderer series on Netflix, which you covered for WFRV, obviously comes to the top of the queue. But little known fact here, you were on David Letterman. were you at UC then, or were you just out of UC?
I was just out of UC. That was in, I think, early 2002.
And you did a bit where you had to guess the skeletal hand of Art Garfunkel, is that correct?
That's correct. Celebrity X-ray Challenge.
There you go. And then recently on Local 12, you actually kind of showed your badass side, and you You saved a baby while you were reporting on an Amber Alert. Is that right?
Well, I don't know if I saved the baby. I mean, I found the baby.
Yeah.
It was very strange. There was an Amber Alert for a little girl who her brother was a heroin addict, and the mother, his mother had confronted him at a pawn shop that morning when he was trying to sell some items there to get money for his heroin habit. And the mom said, I'm going to go in the pawn shop and take care of this. And she said, watch your sister. He stole the car. He drove off with the sister, and there was an Amber Alert. Through the course of just covering the story, I went and knocked on the door of his father's home where he lived, and I heard a baby crying inside, or a child. And, things just snowballed from there. So I stumbled upon the baby, which was pretty crazy.
Who was the guy? I saw that clip. Who was that guy that just threw himself? Was that your cameraman that just threw himself into the window?
No, that was the little girl's dad.
Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, that was his dad. So I was just trying to get the window open, hoping that I could get the girl out of there. Because I didn't. There was a dog barking. Things were going crazy. I had no idea that dog was going to hurt her, so I didn't know if she was familiar with the dog. It was just all very strange.
Well,
so, that was a crazy day.
Yeah, well, before, I guess 3 weeks ago when Making a Murder was released on Netflix, those two stories were probably at the top of your Google queue if you Googled Anjanette Levy. Now it's probably at the very, very top. It's Making a Murder. And if you search on Twitter, and you find a hashtag skeptical reporter face, they probably have your face on there. Is that right?
That's what I'm being told. I received a lot of tweets and messages about my skeptical face, which kind of makes me think I need to work on my resting face.
Well, I think probably, you know, when people are watching this documentary, and it was filmed over 10 years, it's a series, it's 10 episodes, an hour each. I think probably people that are watching it have that same exact face and that same expression as, I just can't believe what I'm watching. I cannot believe what I'm seeing. So I guess as somebody that covered it, on a day-to-day basis, how long did you end up covering this story from beginning to end?
Well, the murder happened presumably on October 31st of 2005. So the young woman, Teresa Holbuck, was reported missing November 3rd. So, you know, November of 2005 till late summer of 2007. So I would say almost 2 years. And then, of course, there were post-conviction motion hearings. So, I mean, the cases were largely over, with the exception of some post-conviction motion hearings that happened in, I think, 2009 and 2010.
So did you feel at the time that you were covering it, and obviously you've got to stay, you know, independent, you've got to stay down the road. Did you feel at the time you were covering it was ever going to get to the level that it is right now? I mean, we've got...
I was always shocked that more national media didn't pick up the story because it was such a crazy, just very sad case. But it was very interesting. I mean, you had some guy, Stephen Avery, who's exonerated of a rape conviction. He spends 18 years in prison for something he didn't do. He was a celebrity. When I moved to Wisconsin, I heard about Stephen Avery, and I found his story fascinating. It's funny because I only contacted him. Wanted to see if he would do a story with me before this happened, just kind of like a follow-up type of story. So he was a celebrity, and you've got this guy who's suing the county that wrongfully convicted him and prosecuted him. You've got this guy who's a celebrity now being the main suspect in a really gruesome murder. So I thought it had all those elements to be a really interesting, huge story. I'm not really sure why. Maybe the national news outlet didn't pick up on it then. I don't know, but I always knew it was a big case and it was a big deal.
Well, it's certainly gotten attention now. I don't know if you finished the series. I know the last time I checked on Twitter, you were through episode 7. Are you through?
I did finish it. I finished it over the weekend. I had to work all through the holidays, so I really didn't have time to.
I love binge watching when I get into something, but I just didn't have that luxury over the week, over the holidays. So I could have watched it, an episode here or there, to get through it.
Was it weird? Was it weird seeing you on there?
Kind of. I mean, I'm used to seeing myself on television, but it was a little strange to see
myself on there in the way that I did, and see me asking questions at the press conferences and stuff like that. That was a little. It's a little strange.
Is it still the biggest story you've covered?
I would say so. I would say it's the biggest criminal case I've ever covered. Yeah, most certainly. It just had so many twists and turns, and there was always something happening with it.
Yeah, so I guess here's where I think that your insight is, because you know, right now everybody's talking about this. You're seeing on the national shows, the Today shows, the Foxes, the CBSs, the NBCs. They're talking with prosecutors. They're talking with defense attorneys, and obviously they have their spins on the whole thing. But I think your insight, as somebody that is a party to which you have no, you're not on anybody's team. I think your insight really gives a good sense of what actually went on. So I guess, did you get a sense from the people that you lived with, in Manitowoc County, that did they have the same feelings that the people that are watching this nationally have towards Stephen Avery right now? What was their sense locally at the time when this was going on?
At the time that it was happening?
Yeah.
I think that when Stephen was first arrested, and he kept claiming, as he still does today, and as his defense team does today, that the evidence was planted, and this was all to kind of stop his lawsuit, his $36 million lawsuit that he had filed. And I think that at the time of his arrest, there were a lot of people in that county who were skeptical that he actually committed this crime. But then you had people on the other side of it that knew the Avery family. The men in that family, some of them have had some issues with women, in which criminal charges were filed in the past. So, and Stephen did have a criminal record before he was wrongfully convicted of the 1985 rape. So he did have a history. So I think that there were people who thought, there were people you would just go into the community. I remember going to a supermarket and just trying to interview a man on the street type. People doing their grocery shopping. Some they didn't want to talk to you on camera. They'd say, "Oh yeah, there's Avery's," or they'd say stuff like that. And then you'd have people on the other side who said they thought he was being framed. And then I think when Brendan Dassey, his nephew, was arrested, I think that was a huge turning point in the case because he confessed to the crime. He implicated himself and his uncle, but then later recanted that statement, saying that it was coerced and he was just kind of trying to say whatever he thought they wanted to hear, and he was guessing and things like that. And there was a news conference given after that arrest by the DA at the time, and there were a lot of horrific, awful details given in that press conference that I think left all of us shell-shocked. And I think then once the shock wore off, you really started to think about it and think, gosh, what's going on here? But I think that kind of turned the tide in that county. I think a lot of people then believed for certain that Stephen Avery was guilty.
Was there, and I think I read this somewhere before, but obviously every local reporter kind of has their own, they want to have their own spin on the story, or they want to be able to dig in somewhere where, it's on uncharted territories. Was there any reporting that you personally were able to uncover that was maybe used in either the documentary or is now being used as part of the narrative of how this story is being told?
I requested, when this first happened, I think you asked all of you asked yourself questions. When he was first charged with the crime, the evidence that we knew about was that his blood was in her SUV, as you saw in the documentary, that her bone fragments were found in his burn pit, her camera and her, Palm Pilot and cell phone were found in his burn barrel, things like that. We knew all of those things. But then at the same time, you kind of thought, well, but was he the one that did it?
was he the one who actually committed the crime, or did he help clean up? Or, you know, you think about all these things, and he claims he was being framed, and you think, gosh, he really was suing the county for a lot of money. So you try to look into all this, and I kind of tried to look into him. I wanted to know, okay, who is Hugh Avery for real? Who is he really? You know, is this guy a good guy, somebody who was just did some things when he was young, or is he somebody who could commit this crime? And I remember requesting his prison file and actually getting those records and going through them and finding some things that were rather disturbing.
So, one of the things that I read, and were you the one that kind of uncovered the animal cruelty thing and the extent to, you know, some of I guess some of the prison writings to his ex-wife.
I broke the story of the letters he had written to his wife and children from prison. So I uncovered that. His attorneys always maintained that was something bad that he did. You didn't, you know, you don't know what it's like to be in prison for something you didn't do, and then your wife is divorcing you. And actually, Stephen Avery told me these things, that he shouldn't have done it. I mean, he called me one night, and we spoke at length about a lot of things, including the day of the murder. So that wasn't used in the documentary. I didn't uncover the animal cruelty thing. I mean, that we knew about that. We found out about that. My research or my requesting the documents more or less uncovered what was going on with him with regard to his wife while he was in prison, and this things he was saying to her and the things that he was doing.
And just to, you know, for some of the people that are listening, some of the things that he was saying was, you know, that when he was going to get out, if she divorced him, or if she wouldn't bring the kids, that he was going to hurt her or kill her, and those are the things that you're talking about. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he and I talked about that at length one night. He called and we spoke about it, and he said he made a mistake. He shouldn't have done that, but he was really upset. He claimed that his wife was claiming she was going to kill the children. So, you know, it was all this stuff. And I remember his attorney, Dean Strang, telling me one time, you know, there's some things about, you know, my guy that might not be great, but it doesn't make him a murderer.
Sure.
So, but I always wanted to know, you know, my big question was, okay, did he do this, and what makes this guy tick? You know, I think those were my big question.
So what was he like, you know, when you were dealing with him on the phone? I mean, the way that he was portrayed on the documentary, at least, was that, you know, this guy wasn't perfect. He did some messed up things when he was younger, but when he did those things, you know, he kind of came clean about it. He admitted his wrong, and you know, obviously the biggest wrong that happened to him or that he was accused of was the sexual abuse, the rape that he was eventually exonerated from, which kind of tells a story. So I guess what was your thoughts on that? Was that the perception that the documentary, the gals that were telling the documentary, is that what your perception was of him as well?
Well, you have to keep in mind, I think they've probably been talking to him for 10 years.
Right.
I talked to him one night on the phone for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So there's a big difference there. And I could see that Stephen, you know, isn't perfect. None of us are perfect. I'm not going to... So I think that what I was hearing from him on the jail phone calls in the documentary was similar to how he spoke with me on the phone. But I do think also he probably has some... you know, there were some other interviews I saw where I felt like he was speaking differently, where he was more forceful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was pretty mild-mannered and tame when he spoke with me.
What was the biggest shocker statement that you heard with your own ears while you were covering the story?
The biggest shocker statement?
Yeah, either from prosecutor's defense or just from, you know, covering it in the courtroom.
Oh, in the courtroom? Gosh. Well, I remember they said Bobby Dassey was testifying that Stephen said something about, I want to get rid of
you know, do you want to help me get rid of a body?
Yeah.
That we were all like, whoa, we had never heard that before. But then I think his defense attorneys cleared that up, that that was more or less, they were talking about it, how it had been on the news, and this wasn't a statement he made requesting their assistance, or that it was something he said in jest after he had appeared on the news and it was reported that she had been to their property and things like that. So it was a big shocker. I mean, I think that, you know, that the press conference announcing Brendan Dassey's arrest, where all those, you know, awful allegations of rape and torture were discussed, I mean, I think that left us all stunned. But I also think, you know, there were a lot of things. I mean, I think these cases are so weird, and they're unlike any that I've ever covered since. You know, watching, we later found out years after the fact that Brendan Dassey's own investigator, you know, a member of his defense team, you know, was coercing him to confess and
crazy
things like that. So that I personally found that incredibly distressing.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't aware that that was going on in the course that all we kept being told was that the kid was going to take a plea. That was his best hope. So,
well, you have that. I mean, and watching the whole thing too. I mean, as a defense attorney, and I've got no legal training whatsoever, nor do I want it. But the way that Len Kaczynski, who was Brendan Dassey's defender, kind of just threw him to the wolves, that's one thing. And then Stephen Avery's defense attorneys, which from the get-go, I mean, they never shied away from the fact that their defense was going to be crooked cops. I mean, to me, that's the biggest that doesn't happen every day. You don't cover stories like that as a reporter every day. So
no, and that was pretty stunning. I mean, the because he kept saying they planted it, it's all planted, and you're like, okay, you know, I remember him specifically telling me on the phone, they took my blood, they have it, they have it. I'm like, who on earth, you know? I figure, yeah, I'm sure they did take your blood, but really, it's at the sheriff's office. I figure it's sitting in a lab somewhere, or it was sent off for testing. And I would never have expected that a vial of Stephen Avery's blood was sitting in a clerk's office for the public to, you know, come in and happen upon and things like that. I mean, it was a case full of so many strange, odd things. And you don't hear about, you do hear defense attorneys accuse police of, you know, not doing things properly in criminal cases, but obviously, I'm not sure you hear about, and I haven't heard about, the claim that there was a vast criminal, you know, conspiracy going on like this to frame somebody. So that, I mean, it was kind of stunning, and I think we were all surprised, too, when we learned about Manitowoc County's continued involvement in the investigation, because we were told that they weren't actively involved in the actual investigation, that they were providing some support.
Yeah.
So I think we were surprised to learn about that, too. But there were so many surprising things that I would have to, like, sit down and think about it and actually type out my top 10 list of shocking things that you...
Oh, it's crazy. And I can't even imagine, like, obviously when 99% of the people that are reading about this or listening to the podcast, like, they know what they know from the 10 hours that they just binged on watching this on Netflix. Like, I can't imagine for you to be able to, like, have to sift through, you know, however long that you covered this story and just think, I cannot believe that I heard that. I can't believe I saw that today. Like, that probably won't happen to you again.
Yeah, it probably won't, unless these cases are retried and I somehow end up covering them. But, you know, I doubt it. You know, I doubt that will happen. There were so many strange things in this case. It was weird. And it was actually interesting, though, to watch all the attorneys in these cases, too. I mean, the defense team was really good. I mean, they were very good attorneys. They were a very good attorney. And, you know, members of the prosecution were good, too. So it was interesting to watch all of that go on, and, you know, that you could tell there really wasn't much love lost between the two sides. So there was always some kind of, it almost looked like armed combat going on between
right.
the two sides. So there was a lot, and there was,
you know, the 10-hour, you know, I give Lauren more credit for, you know, being able to bring, consolidate
that case into 10 hours, because it's just such a huge monster of a case. But at the same time, you know, they can't fit every little detail in.
Yeah. Well, obviously, not many of the Halbachs were interviewed in the series, the Netflix series. How often did you talk to them during the course of the case?
We didn't talk to. I mean, Teresa's brother Mike was the main family spokesperson, so he was the guy we would contact. He was, you know, the parents never wanted to talk to the media. That her sisters were very young. Her older brother Tim didn't want to speak with the media either, so we always talked to Mike, and we would call him in between every once in a while, but mostly we'd see him at hearings, and he'd talk to us after the hearing about what he thought or how the family was feeling. So it's my understanding that the Halbachs declined to take part in the documentary.
Did you ever ask, or did anybody ask, was there ever an explanation for the pinprick hole in the vial that held Steve Avery's blood?
You know, and I don't remember. I feel bad that I don't remember if there was any explanation. I feel badly that I don't recall. I don't know if that's just part of taking blood. I just have no idea. And I can try to get that answer for you, but I don't remember that part.
Well, and that's one of the, like, I think probably, and you mentioned it before, that's one of the, like, biggest shocking things that I saw was, you know, the fact that his blood was just sitting in a clerk's office, the seal on it had been broken, and there was a pinprick into the vial that held his blood, and then, you know, you've got Steve Avery's blood that was...
And a piece of scotch tape over the...
Yeah.
Evidence. Yeah, that was... I remember sitting in court when we learned that there was actually a vial of blood. I remember that because there was like a motion hearing about it on whether or not it would be allowed, and the prosecution wanted the trial delayed so they could have the FBI perform some testing for the preservative EDTA, which they claim would not have been in the blood in the RAV4 if
it came from Stephen Avery's finger. So it was... That was stunning. I remember my jaw. It takes a lot to shock me, but I remember my jaw literally dropping.
Yeah.
When we found out that existed, I just couldn't believe it.
And the EDTA, which you mentioned, was I guess it's a preservative that they put in the blood vials that is added in there so that the blood doesn't spoil. And presumably, if the blood that was Teresa or that was Stephen Avery's was in the car did not have EDTA in it, then it was not from the sample. And then all of a sudden, the FBI is called in to do a test to see if the EDTA is in the blood. Can you talk about, you know, I guess that circus? Because I read today that EDTA testing for blood has not happened before or since that trial.
Well, it did happen before that trial. It happened in the O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And it had not been, and I believe that the defense claimed, and I would have to look into this before giving, I don't want to say something that's wrong, but that O.J. was acquitted. So I think that the defense in that case did a pretty good job of attacking the EDTA testing conducted by the FBI back in that trial, during that trial. And the defense in this case was incredibly critical because they were very critical of this testing because the FBI had to develop a protocol.
And if I recall correctly, they had to develop a whole new protocol. And they did that within a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And the defense disputes that those results to this day because they don't believe there were the proper detection levels and things like that. So that was a very interesting part of the case.
Would you say that, you know, before the FBI came and testified about the EDTA test, that the feeling was that it was, I guess, trending in the favor of Stephen Avery's judgment?
Really good days during that case. I mean, I think they did a really good job there were days that did a really good job, and then there were days that, you know, the state had
presented evidence that was interesting as well. And so, you know, not everything that the state, you know, claimed or contended was in the documentary. But there were days, I don't know, I mean, there were a lot of people, if you would just talk to people out on the street, they just thought the Planned Blood thing was bogus.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, oh, whatever, you know. And then there were other people who were like, oh, I bet they planted it. So it was kind of like split, you know. So I think that the EDTA testing, when the FBI, Mark LeBeau, when he testified about his test results, mm-hmm. I think that it was a bad day for the defense. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
They did a really good job attacking some of the other evidence.
Sure.
Or the other witnesses. So it just, you know, it was
a turning point, but it didn't seem to matter because they still came back swinging every day.
Yeah.
It didn't matter to them. They weren't like, okay, we give up now.
Right. So. And nor should they. They were paid $400,000? Is that what he ended up paying them?
No, they were paid $240,000.
Oh, wow.
Stephen's settlement was $400,000 from the Manitowoc County lawsuit, and then 160 of that went, I believe, to his civil attorneys, and then the remaining 240 Stephen gave to, obviously, his lawyers. But
right.
It was my understanding that money was exhausted pretty quickly. He had really good lawyers.
Yeah, he did. I mean, and I think that, and I brought that up in the introduction. I think more than anything, whether he was guilty or not, I mean, it's not up for me to decide, or you, or whoever. It was up to the jurors, and obviously the appellate courts have upheld that. But I think probably the biggest thing that came out of this was how I guess the system is kind of set up. And you look at the discrepancy between Stephen Avery and his representation versus Brendan Dassey, who obviously didn't have the money to pay for great attorneys. At the beginning, I mean, his first attorney was terrible to the point where he was kicked off of the case. I guess his second attorney did an okay job from what they showed, but I think that's probably a big story, is how flawed that system is, and if you don't have the money, how much of a burden that can be for you.
And I agree with you on that, because I think that is something that's a major point that needs to come out of this. You know, Stephen found the money to get to buy the best and to pay, you know, to pay for the best representation he could get. Brendan didn't, and his mother didn't have the money to get the best. And I'm just telling you, it was so sad to watch, you know, a kid be put on trial for such serious crime and not have the best after sitting through 6 or 7 weeks of watching the best.
Well, I mean, so some of the saddest...
Don't get me wrong. I mean, this was a horrible crime. It was a horrendous crime, but Brendan Dassey has always saddened me a great deal. The fact that he didn't have the representation that his uncle did.
It was, I think, the saddest part of the whole thing was he was described as, you know, having a low IQ at a fourth grade reading level. The saddest thing, when he just gets done confessing to his two investigators, and as soon as he does it, he doesn't understand the ramifications of what he's told them, to the point where he asks them, you know, I think it's like 2 o'clock when he's talking to them at the police station or wherever they were interviewing him. He asked him if he was going to be back in time for sixth period to turn in a project. He didn't understand.
Yeah, I mean, that was very, very sad. I mean, that whole tape is just, and they obviously couldn't show a 4-hour tape in a documentary.
Right.
And there were just a lot of really awful things in that tape. I think that you hit on it, the saddest part of that, you know, maybe not the saddest part, but one of the very sad parts of that is that I don't think he did understand.
Yeah.
And I he probably understood what he was saying was bad. It wasn't a good thing, but he obviously thought he was going back to school.
Yeah.
You know?
And then he thought he wanted to get back in time for WrestleMania. you know, he just didn't understand. I think he thought maybe that if he told the, and this is probably what his defense was going for, if he told the investigators what they wanted to hear, he was going to be able to get on with his life.
And he may have thought that. You know, I can't speak for, I remember talking to him on the phone one night, you know, shortly after his confession was ruled admissible. His mom had him call me, and I said, why did you say all this stuff? And he just said, I don't know. And I was just, you know, it was like a brief phone call, but I was just like, you know, we hadn't seen the tape or anything. And I just couldn't understand why somebody, if it wasn't true, why did you say it, you know?
Right. But
it's just, I think that you have to just watch that tape and draw your own conclusions.
Yeah.
I think you have to watch it in its entirety. You know, I'm not going to make a judgment about that tape. But, you know, it's just, that part of the case is just really, the Brendan Dassey portion has always been very, very sad.
Two more, and I'll get you out of here. And again, Anjanette Levy, Local 12, she was a reporter with Green Bay WFRV for 6 years, covered the Stephen Avery trial on a daily basis. There was a point, Anjanette, where I think the documentary makers were, and I don't know how big of a story this was, so I want to get your perspective on this. When they were talking about the deleted voicemails, Teresa Halbach's deleted voicemails, and I think the brother, it wasn't the brother, it was the ex-boyfriend, had gotten into her cell phone account, had just said that he guessed the username and password correctly. The defense spent some time with some communications forensic people, and they determined that at some point whoever had gotten into that account had deleted some voicemails. Was that a big narrative? Was that just a part of the I guess theater of the documentary? How big of a storyline was that during the trial?
I don't remember it being that big of a deal.
Yeah.
I think we all thought it was weird that somebody would go in and, I mean, it wasn't weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if cell phones are different these days. If something happened to you or I don't know anybody that would know my password.
Yeah.
They might be able to guess it after a few tries.
Password and username. Yeah.
I remember it being something that was weird, but I don't remember it being a huge storyline.
So, last one, and this is mainly dealing with some of the interviews that have come out since the series has been released on Netflix. The prosecutor saying that filmmakers left some crucial things out. He talks about Stephen Avery calling Teresa Halbach twice with a Star 67, disguising who he was. He specifically requested her from Auto Trader to come out, and when he did, he came out in a bath towel, which is kind of creepy. They found some of his DNA on the inside latch of the car, which suggests that he was the one that moved the car. I guess someone that independently covered the case, do you think the filmmakers mainly got the story right? Was there anything they left out that surprised you?
Well, there were some things about the state's theory that weren't included in there. And I think that you mentioned those things, the DNA on the hood latch, the cables on the car, on the RAV4 had been disconnected, the battery cables. The Star 67 calls that did happen, and then he called her back subsequently, like 4:35 that day or 4:30. So those things all did happen, and they were all presented as evidence in the trial. So I know the state's feeling pretty upset. They were also taking issue with the fact that the bullet with Teresa Halbach's DNA was fired from a gun in Stephen Avery's bedroom, you know, a gun that he kept there. They were, the things I've read, they're saying they're upset that those items weren't included. But the defense has kind of said they believe that DNA could have been transferred on the hood latch. So, I mean, I think everything they put in the documentary certainly happened. They can't fit in a 6-week trial and a 10-hour documentary.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm not going to judge them. They can, I'm sure, answer that for themselves. They claim they included all of the critical evidence that the state presented.
Well, Anjanette, your insights are certainly appreciated here on Fort Thomas Matters Radio. Thank you so much. How can people connect with you?
I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/AnjanetteL, and then I'm on Twitter at Anjanette5.
So you can update your profile to now say David Letterman saved a baby, and yes, I am the skeptical reporter face reporter. Is that right?
I guess I could.
All right. Well, Anjanette, thank you so much for being on. This is Mark Collier with Anjanette Levy on Fort Thomas Matters Radio.
Thank you.